Dr. Gwen Westerman is a professor of English and Humanities, in fact, is the director of the Humanities Department at Minnesota State University at Mankato. She specializes in multicultural and Native American literature. She also serves as director of the Native American Literature Symposium and is a recipient of several prestigious grants and has published widely on contemporary American Indian literature. She is the author of a book by the name of Minnesota Makoche, The Land of the Dakota, and she joins us now from her office down at the on the campus of Minnesota State. Dr. Westerman, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And I want to thank you, first of all, in the book, and I'll probably get it wrong anyway, but I was very interested to see that you have kind of a pronunciation table for some of the letters and how they're pronounced in Dakota, and hopefully I can get those right. I've been studying very hard.
We thought it was really important to have a pronunciation guide there so that people could begin to pronounce our Dakota names, place names correctly.
First of all, I want to tell you, I really enjoyed the book. It was very interesting. I thought the scholarship was wonderful, and it really was a terrific book. And I want to talk a little bit more about the authorship of it, but I know it was released last year, and was the timing of it intended for the observance of the Dakota-U.S. conflict of 1862?
It was released in September of 2012, and yes, when we began working on this project with the Minnesota Historical Society Press, we wanted it to be published in 2012 because of the 150th commemoration of the Dakota-U.S. War. But we also wanted a book to be out among all of the other activities and events that were happening in 2012 that focused on the land and the stories of the land and on our history as Dakota people beyond just that short period of the war.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about how, I mean, I know that the start of the book, the impetus of the book happened long before last year. Tell us a little bit about how it came to be.
Well, this has been a four-year collaboration, and the Two Rivers Development Corporation got funding from the Indian Land Tenure Foundation to do research on Dakota land tenure up to 1862 to establish that this is a Dakota place. And so Bruce White, my co-author, and I came into the project in 2008, and we spent 2 years doing research and interviews. Bruce's team was responsible for researching all the written and historical records, and my team was responsible for oral histories and interviews with Dakota people. So that was a two-year project, and we got so much information we weren't sure how we were ever going to cram it all into one book. So we started another two-year writing project that was funded with legacy funds from the state of Minnesota. And we winnowed and sorted our information and came up with the organization for the book that we have today.
And what I thought was interesting, too, first of all, the fact that you co-authored it with Bruce White, who has done much writing, actually, about Native peoples in Minnesota. That's a wonderful local connection because Bruce's brother, Tim, has lived in Cook County for many years. But what I found interesting was, number, and you mentioned it, that you did a lot of the oral histories and had to travel widely to do that, to Canada and other states in the U.S., largely because of a result of the fact that so many Dakota people are widespread now due to the fact that they were driven from Minnesota. But also, it was even more than the two of you. There were a lot of other people that collaborated on this as well, weren't there?
Yes, there were. Bruce's team included Howard Vogel, who is a law professor at Hamline University. Kate Bean, who is the Cota graduate student at the University of Minnesota and has personal connections to the stories that are here. And I'm going to draw a blank here on some of the other people on Bruce's team. Tom Shaw, mm-hmm. who has done significant work on Tolliver's journal. And it was a good mix from that side, from the historical record. And then the oral history team included Glenn Washichina, who is from Sioux Valley, Manitoba, and a fluent first language Dakota speaker and teacher, and also Aaron Griffin, who is from Sistan Wapton Oyate and is an anthropologist.
What struck me as much as anything about the book, and again, I'm going to back up first. Obviously, in living in Minnesota with the Dakota cultures that have existed here, the Ojibwe cultures, there have been a lot of books written about the history of Native peoples in Minnesota. What's different about yours? I think I know, but I'd like our listeners to know what's different about yours. Why was there a need for this book?
There was a need for this book because there was a significant need for our Dakota history to be told from a Dakota perspective and to use our Dakota sources as the primary and authoritative sources for a history of the land to tell the story of Mene Sota Makoche. And I think that's what sets this book apart, in that it begins with our primary story, not the secondary story of the war in 1862, mm-hmm. but our primary story as Dakota people with our creation story and our placement here by the Creator at the confluence of the Minnesota and Mississippi rivers.
An area called, I believe, referred to as Bedote. And,
yes.
And I want to talk about that in just a little bit. I'm assuming it's very difficult to write. Oh, well, the one thing I guess they wanted to establish is that the according to the Dakota creation story, Minnesota and the area that you talk about is in fact the homeland. And that really leads, it seems to me, to can understand how the feelings that have arisen over the fact that that's an area that became occupied as Fort Snelling, which became a symbol of imperialism and colonialism. And it has been, I'm sure, very difficult for Dakota people.
Well, our homeland, our original homeland stretched from the southern shore of Lake Superior all the way up into what is now Canada, and down through the Dakotas and Minnesota and parts of Iowa and Nebraska. So we have a very vast homeland that mm-hmm. includes the big woods and the prairie. So that 9 square miles at Fort Snelling has been a contested area for quite a long time. And it does. It has a lot of connotations. It has a lot of history. It has a lot of negative symbolism mm-hmm. when it comes to history of Dakota people in this area.
A couple of things struck me significantly in the book. One, and you cover movement of people, of the Dakota people, and both from summer and winter, their culture, their hunting and agricultural practices, their games, and it obviously you spend a lot of time on treaties, and I'm sure it's difficult to write about the relationship of the Dakota with, as it turns out, the settlers without doing that. The thing I found most interesting was you have set down the Treaty of Traverse des Sioux, 1851, with three different interpretations. And interpretation is the wrong word, but you've got the original language of the treaty that the U.S. government wrote. Then you've got the translation of that into Dakota. And then, as I understand it, the third one is kind of the translation back into English. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And it's interesting, obviously I can't read the Dakota one, but it's interesting the difference between the two English translations. And I'm assuming that that's what caused so much difficulty as far as understanding, as far as what the treaties really were saying.
Well, I had heard for a long time that there had been a copy of the Traverse des Sioux Treaty of 1851 written in the Dakota language, and that someone had it. Ramsey and Luke Lee commanded Stephen Riggs to translate the American text into Dakota, and that's what he did. And we found this copy of the treaty in Riggs's handwriting at the end of a series of traders' papers. And it had been printed in the Dakota Friend by I think it was John Williamson, or no, I can't remember if it's the Ponds, but it had been printed in the paper, but we had it in its original form, in the original handwriting. We took a look at that, we transcribed it, and then began very tedious and painstaking work to translate it back into English and then compare the American version with the English, with the version that the Dakota people were provided. And there are lots of discrepancies.
There are
sections left out, like the fact that $1.6 million would go back to the federal government after 50 years. There are kinship terms and other kinds of cultural references in the Dakota version of the treaty that are nowhere in the American version. And I think that is telling, in that kinship is an important aspect of Dakota life. And when those kinship terms are in the treaty, this is what they were agreeing to. You know, that we'll take care of each other.
Right.
And so sometimes people will say, well, they signed the treaty, they knew what was in it, and now we have what they were told was in it, and it doesn't match up with the English version.
Exactly. Professor Westerman, it seems to me that one of the things that defines any culture, many things, but language and story and all the rest of it, but as much as anything, it seems to me that place has to do with defining our culture and how we feel about ourselves. And you write in the introduction that the relationship of a people to the lands where they live is crucial for understanding their history and culture. And you spend a lot of time in the book talking about the sense of place and loss of sense of place that occurred with Dakota as far as their homelands in Minnesota. Can you talk a little bit about your experience in it, first of all, as a Dakota woman, and secondly, as you were writing this book, experiencing that?
Often I talk to people about Minnesota as a Dakota place by having them look at a map and to point out all of the Dakota place names, whether it's towns or rivers or creeks or lakes, that carry our imprint on the land, even the state of Minnesota itself. So our marks are indelible that signify this as a Dakota place. It's often overlooked. I think, you know, when you see something on a daily basis, it often becomes invisible or so familiar you don't think about it anymore. And if people would just open their eyes a little bit, they would see our marks on this land. It's also the stories that we gathered, the oral histories that we gathered about specific places and landmarks and sacred places all throughout this area that we have heard and that we've carried forward as the Dakota people for generations, and to make those connections back in a book like this that's available to all kinds of people to read was very important for us, that we didn't arrive here, you know, haphazardly 150 or 250 years ago, but we had been here for much, much longer than an American historical record gives us credit for.
And it's a fact that for a long time, and to a degree still is, that lands that were sacred to the Dakota people, burial mounds, Indian mounds, other sacred places, were just destroyed as the settler civilization developed and expanded and all of the rest of it. And in fact, I know, and you talk about it in the book, that efforts to try and preserve some of those really didn't happen. Has that changed at all in terms of some of the areas that are sacred to the Dakota people? Is there a more positive response from the settler culture, from white civilization, to preserving those?
I wish I could give you a definitive answer and say, yes, things are changing. There are still times just within the last few years where I can think of one specifically at Lake Chetak where they were putting in new sewer lines for the houses around the lake, and they uncovered artifacts, and they tried to locate people, Dakota people, who could help them with those, and there was no way for a group to say, yes, these were definitely the Dewakantuan people or Wahpetuan people, and our community is going to step forward and help with this. And so often they just got covered up again or moved or disturbed. So it's a really difficult and involved process sometimes. But I also think it's hard for contemporary people to make that connection to something that they think is so far in the distant past. About a month ago, I cut out an article from our local paper here in Mankato about a small cemetery in the center of a cultivated field that a local resident had driven past and noticed that it was gone, and went to the county and said, what happened to this little cemetery? And the landowner said, well, nobody was caring for it anymore, and it's in the middle of my field, so I just plowed over it. And there was a lot of outcry about that. And when it's, you know, a settler cemetery, or whether it's the Dakota burial mound, people have to be able to make that connection that it's an important place and a sacred place that needs to be protected.
And unfortunately, once it's gone, it's gone. There's no way to bring it back.
Yeah.
And I know that several years ago, I'm not too sure what, I was trying to research it today and wasn't able to find out, but I know several years ago there was a lot of controversy over an area called Coldwater Spring, which is really at the heart of Barote. As you mentioned, near the confluence of the Minnesota and Mississippi rivers, which is at the heart of what was sacred to the Dakota, and had fallen into ruin. And after a number of activists had tried to, I think, get that land back, the National Park Service said, well, they did develop a park around it, which really, I think, in the minds of the activists, was not paying the proper respect at all. Do you know what's happened with that?
I don't know the current status of it. I was there 2 years ago to take photographs for the book and for an art project that I was working on at the time. And I hadn't ever been there before. I went in 2010. And when I got there, I had to call somebody and say, I'm in this polluted, disgusting, rundown industrial complex, am I in the right place? And I was told, yes, you're in the right place. So it was quite a shock to see crumbling buildings and graffiti, and in a place that is so important for us culturally. But I know there have been some efforts to start to revitalize that area.
Once again, the name of the book is Minnesota Makoche, The Land of the Dakota. We've been visiting with Professor Gwen Westerman, who, along with Bruce White, co-authored the book. And once again, first of all, thanks so much for taking time on a Friday evening to be with us, Professor Westerman. And thank you as well for the book.
You're welcome.
Really well done, and I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about it. It's very special.
It is indeed. Thanks so much. Have a good weekend.